This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on June 12th, 2013, at the world's best conference, the Norwegian Developers Conference. We are on location, and we have two guests who just finished a session comparing AngularJS and Ember, which was a cage match. So, would you guys introduce yourselves?
You go.
Hey, I'm Tom Dale. I'm one of the authors of EmberJS. Yes, it was definitely a cage match. It was a no bars were held in this cage match.
Hi, I'm Rob Connery, and it's my third cage match, I think. And, yeah, it was Angular and Ember. It was a lot of fun. I had a good time.
Unfortunately, I was talking at the same time you guys had a cage match. So can you recreate sort of the opening moments? What were you looking to
Lots
achieve?
Of screaming. Lots of biting, I think.
Flailing of limbs.
Tom bit me once.
Yeah. So my favorite quote partway through was, you said something, Rob. I set you up for something. And,
oh, yeah.
And you, aren't you going to respond? And Tom said, I've just never watched someone drown like this.
That was a good singer. Oh, that's sick, yeah.
Yeah, it was, live coding is one of the hardest things you can do as a presenter. I know I have flubbed so many demos in my life that I have a real aversion to doing it. So when Rob emailed me and asked me if I wanted to do this cage match, I have no idea why I said yes, because this has bit me so many times in the past. But it was a lot of fun. So we got together a little bit beforehand, and we basically just had this challenge where we got up in front of the audience, and Peter Cooper was nice enough to basically host and be the moderator, make sure that we didn't get too many bruises, I guess. And so we just got up there, and we basically re-implemented the same kind of features, once in Angular on Rob's machine and then on Ember on my machine.
Oh, wow. So what was the app?
Well, we started out doing the simplest thing. You know, how do you install each framework, and then how do you just work with some data? So we did that. And that was pretty interesting. And then we moved from there into routing. Like, let's have a page with routes on it and click between views.
And that's when things went bad.
Yeah, that's when things went kind of nuts, for me at least. Because with Angular, you know, with Angular, it's really fun to do the demo, because all you got to do is wrap a few tags in there, and then you're binding things, and off you go. But then when you try and do more structured stuff, well, all that's out the window, and you kind of have to back up and start again, dig in with the modules. And
I think seeing like the Tech Pub screencast about Angular was actually really, it informed a lot of the API design we did in Ember, because we realized we thought through a lot of these things. We thought through how do you handle routing, how do you handle URLs, how do you handle templates. But unfortunately, the demo was awful, right? There was so much setup you had to do to even just get a quick binding working. So we basically, in a lot of ways, went back to the drawing board, and we thought, how can we get something that demos as well as Angular does in the first couple minutes? Mm-hmm. And I think that was an advantage that we had, was that I think we've matched the ease of use in Angular when you're getting started, just like quickly do a small little demo. But then as the app starts to grow in the demo, you get nice things like routing that happen for free.
Yep.
Oh, routing's for free. So both of these frameworks, if you compare them feature by feature, they're both implementing sort of the same feature set. There's two-way data binding, there's routing, there's views and templates and partial.
Yeah, I think if you look at it as a feature checklist, you can check off many of the same features.
Yeah. And then it just comes down to how do you implement those, and where's the friction at?
Well, it's interesting. Tom and I were talking about this at breakfast, that Angular is much more component-based. It feels like that to me. You work with the notion of UI components, and we had a point in the talk today where Tom looked at me and said, okay, well, how would you do that? Well, this is like a schism in your brain, because Angular, you don't do that. You know, you use a directive, and you make this reusable component, and that gets injected with things. And so with Ember, it's a little bit different. You have some convention that's built around the notion of URLs and embedded templating and so on. And it's a fascinating change of doing things.
So, you know, like the idea that the language you speak influences the way you think, right? And so the same thing, the library you work with influences, like you were saying. Well, you don't do that with Angular, so you don't do that in your applications, right? So what's the overall effect of, like, picking a language? Does that dictate your app? Like,
I think what I said was, why would I soil my application? Are we still doing the cage match?
So I just don't... I don't think it's acceptable that if your designer comes to you and is like, hey, we want this UI, we think this is the best for the user, I don't think a valid response is, well, it's really hard to do that in our framework, so we're not going to do that, right? That's not a valid thing that you get to say. So I think one thing that we spend a lot of time as framework developers working on is composability, right? Because it's very easy for someone to come to you and say, hey, I need this feature, I need routing, right? And then you basically just tack on routing. And you say, like, I need reusable components. So you tack on reusable components. But actually taking the time to step back and think, okay, how do all these things fit together? That composability, that's why we had all this API churn in Ember, right? Because we weren't happy with one feature that didn't work with another feature. That composability was super, super important. And I think that we've ended up in a place, because of all that API churn we had in the early days, I think our 1.0 is super solid.
It is an interesting aspect of Ember versus Angular is you have all the little Lego pieces. And that's kind of what Angular is. A bunch of Lego pieces that you can tack together and make an app or make something that sucks. You know, and you're wide open to shoot yourself in the foot if you don't implement it carefully. And Ember kind of pushes you a little bit, like, no, here's the blueprint. I want you to start at a logical place, and then we're gonna move you through the blueprint. And for a lot of people, I mean, that's friction when you start out. Because you're like, wait, I don't want to do it your way, and you fight it. It's like using Rails, right? You fight it. Oh, fine, I'll just do it your way. And then you're happy you did it, because you're getting work done.
You definitely need to buy into what did Tom and Yehuda think how you should right. build web applications. That's definitely required.
So there's different kind of crossover points between, like, okay, if you want to customize things, like in Angular, you're off into directives and filters and stuff, right? Custom uh-huh. stuff. And then what is that level that you drop to in Ember? Because we didn't get into that really in your talk.
With
much.
Helpers, you made a helper.
Helpers.
So it's more helper based where you're going to pull things into.
So would you say, Tom, would you say if you can think of it in terms of Rails or ASP.NET MVC, if you can think of it in those frameworks, you can think of it in Ember. Does that make sense?
Think about helpers?
Well, no, just think about, like, how would I do this in Ember? Well, how would you do it in Rails?
I don't think it really maps because, okay. As we were talking about it at breakfast this morning, despite the fact that many frameworks use the term MVC, the difference between server-side MVC and client-side MVC, like Cocoa, for example, is completely different, right? Because on a server, you get a fresh, clean state every time a request comes in. So server-side MVC is all about handling the request, building up the state, delivering it, and then tearing it back down. With client-side, the real challenge is how do we manage that state over kind of a long period of time? And I think most importantly, the challenge that we've given to ourselves is we think that URLs are really important. So a lot of the stuff we've had to figure out for Ember is, okay, well, how do we marry the concepts of kind of like desktop MVC with the fact that we have a URL? And I think that's our real strength, and I think we've nailed it.
So that was something that you guys discussed. You said routing, or like that URLs are fundamental, and you made the point even that you're not a web developer if you're not thinking about URLs, right? So which pretty good way to wake up a crowd. So what is that difference? Like, that's not a concern in Angular at
no,
all?
No, in Angular, and I think Backbone too, I'll go ahead and say that. Like, you're making a single page app that lives in its own self. And so Tom and I were talking about it in the morning. He's like, but, you know, how do I get back to the state of the app at that one spot? And in Backbone, that's a conscious choice. Like, you know, sometimes you want to push people down a certain path that you don't want to link directly to, because maintaining state in Backbone is not an easy thing to do. Let's put it that way. When I say maintaining state, I mean, like, if you close the page, you come back to it. You have to build up everything all over again, all the data. You got to go request it. And that's not an easy thing to do. And you have to do it manually, and you end up with a ton of code, and then all these things start crossing your brain. With Angular, it's not as hard, because the controllers and the injection really kind of go hand in hand, but the URLs come second by far. It's, oh, you want to hold that state? Well, go ahead, and then you have to think about what control comments on.
Yeah, I consider your web application broken if I hit refresh and I don't see the same thing I was seeing before. But everyone screws this up. Everyone screws it up. It's not because people are idiots. It's because it's a really hard problem. And unless you have the core primitives at the heart of the framework to deal with all this crap for you, you're going to mess it up, right? Because it's a thing you constantly have to be thinking about. And when you're on deadline, your boss is breathing over your shoulder to get something out, the URLs are the first thing you toss. And I think that's really bad. I think that breaks the web.
So what is the sweet spot for the framework build for Ember?
In terms of the applications that you
build? Yeah, like what types of applications do you think fit the best? Or what did you have in mind when you were building it?
Yeah. So I think that people's, I was telling Rob this, I think people's kind of formative experiences really inform kind of their worldview. And so my first real professional programming gig was working on huge apps. So specifically I was working on the Mobile Me web apps, which became the iCloud web apps. you probably saw maybe a WWDC, you saw the iWork apps. These are really big apps, and they're all written in Sprout Core. That was my formative experience. So I think for me, what I need out of a framework is something that will let me add new features over time on a big team, and adding a new feature shouldn't break old features, right? So we actually do this kind of people call it functional reactive programming, right? This model where the data basically flows throughout the system. We have something very, basically that's how Ember works. And what it means is that as you start adding features or another developer starts adding features, you're not constantly going back and patching things up because you broke something. And I think that's really important. And I think our strong conventions really help, especially when you're on a team beyond one person, because it's very important to me as a framework author that if two or more developers look at the same problem, that problem should decompose into the same objects in their head. To me, that's very important. And I think having naming conventions and having these very conventional objects in the system helps, especially spread the work out over a team.
You were talking earlier about state, you know, and maintaining the state. And I wonder if you guys could talk about the difference. For instance, you mentioned scope, right? And you have the scope. And then what is actually, like in Ember, what's holding that state? And how are you kind of meaning that?
Sure. So it's very similar, actually, to Coco in the sense that you have a controller which presents a model to the template. And all of that setup happens for you automatically from Ember. So basically, when you come in at a URL, let's say you come in to /photo/1. Well, Ember knows how to take /photo/1 and turn that into the photo model with an ID of 1. And then it basically just takes that, passes it to a controller, and then the template sees that and renders it on the screen.
I blanked out right there, like having a jet lag moment.
AngularJS, you have the scope then. Is the scope what's
holding it? The scope is, I don't know why it is so hard to put good words around what the scope is and does. It's this object that gets passed from the controller or the directive or the module or basically anything. It gets passed down into the view. So if you want to attach data to it, you can, and then it just is invisibly expressed in the view. So today I hit our API and I dropped an object called API onto the scope. Scope.api equals this stuff. And then in the view, I could just use API.whatever directly in the template. So Angular just marries those two things together. So that's an explicit thing. I think Ember's, like as Tom was saying, Ember's a little bit different in that it kind of transparently puts together this model that you then can play with, you know, call functions on and do whatever. Angular's more explicit about it. The scope gets injected in and then kind of just gets sent down to the view.
So I think the elegant thing about the scope in Angular is that it just uses prototypal inheritance, right? So it's literally just using prototypal inheritance built into the language. And I think that's very elegant and that's a very nice solution. However, I do think it starts to break down a little bit when you start to have very deeply nested UIs, because now reasoning about how things are inheriting from their parent scope, should they be in there, and you end up with this really confusing directive API, like, do you want an isolate scope? Do you want to inherit? Which scope are you inheriting from? And it becomes very difficult for new developers to reason about. And I think our built-in isolation is actually a better model for bigger apps.
You can share scope between controllers, and that's when things get really strange.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things you struggle with, you know, when you're learning how to use Angular, and especially the isolated scope situation. And people, I think, generally would feel like, oh, I always want to isolate the scope. But you don't have to, you know, and it's tempting. Like today in the demo, Tom said, okay, well, how are you going to do this? You know, it's looping over some stuff. And so I was like, well, okay, you know, I'll break apart my UI and I'll use a directive. And then I was thinking, well, how's the directive going to get the data? Well, right there I presented with a choice. Do I pass in some little bit of data into this explicit function, or do I now, oh boy, and right there my brain locked, and I failed. And, you know, Tom, like, raised his arms in victory. And, oh,
I don't think I gloated that much. Maybe.
No, I just... But yeah, so that's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing, and I would say if the framework was more explicit, do this, then you don't have that choice, and in some ways that's better. Yeah, I'll go ahead and say it. Don't close.
So one thing at the end was the question was, you know, say something nice about the other framework. Mm-hmm. And the thing, Tom, that you pointed out about Angular is testability is there's a better story there at this point, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you say about that?
The Angular guys have just done a tremendous job in putting testing first. They've poured a lot of energy, so they have not testacular, what's it called now?
Karma.
Karma. So they have Karma, which is an awesome thing, and I really love the fact that basically built in, as you're approaching the framework, everyone talks about their testing story. I think that's really good, and it's somewhere that we're actively trying to catch up with right now. So in the most recent release, we've started shipping a package called Ember Testing, which is a series of helpers for dealing with asynchronous integration testing. It's always been possible because Ember decouples your objects. And because it actually uses a very similar dependency injection system in the sense that you're defining classes and then Ember, the framework, creates the instances and wires them all up. It makes it very easy to do unit tests in isolation, but historically doing integration tests has required a little insider baseball to figure out what the framework is doing. But we're actively working on it because I think the Angular guys have done a tremendous job.
One of the interesting things about the Angular testing story, and I think this is honestly why I tend to gravitate more towards Angular, is, I mean, all the things that we've been talking about are kind of theoretical, and, you know, they're interesting approaches. But when it comes to testing and understanding Angular, you're just working most of the time with basic objects. Like the scope is, you can inject whatever you want into your controller, and the controller will accept it and think, okay, it's just an object, and will tack things onto it, and then you can play with it later on. So that injection story is amazing. Same with the services. When you're testing the routes and you want to, like, send a specific route stuff into the into Angular controller, it's just an object. It's a naked, crazy object. There's not much you need to do to it. And even, like, the resource story, you just have to, you know, put in some basic methods and send it in, and boom. That makes testing so easy. And then also understanding it conceptually, so easy. But then sometimes things that are super easy, you know, right? You make some dumb decisions along the way. So it's a trade-off.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit more complexity when you're learning the framework, because for us, we require you to do things correctly from the beginning. There's no... we're not going to give you any foot guns to make it easier. But I think testing helpers help a lot here, because and just having the material just so you know how you should be thinking about how these objects... I think that we actually support using, like, bare, plain POJOs. Does everyone know what a POJO? Is that a common enough term? Okay. So a plain JavaScript object, that can be your model. You can totally test with it. But I think the Ember, the object model, actually gives you some really nice stuff, and I think most developers end up tending to use that instead.
Yep.
Does that influence change detection in Ember? Or how does change detection work in varying things to it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think probably the most obvious difference between Ember and Angular is that with Angular, you basically put something onto the scope, and you can bind to objects. You can, from your DOM, you can bind to any of those objects or properties in the scope, and if they change, it automatically updates. And you don't need to use a getter or setter. So you basically say object.prop equals foo, and that will actually go to the DOM and update it. But of course, you might be wondering, how does Angular actually know that it needs to go and update the DOM? And the answer to this is dirty checking. So basically, the more objects you have in your scope, the more work the framework has to do, because it has to basically loop over all of those objects looking for the changes. And this actually gets much, much worse if you start having large arrays. Because remember, it has to loop through the entire array looking for stuff. Now, what we do in Ember instead is we have these called accessors, right? So you have objects and you say, you know, like model.getTitle. Model.getName. This is obviously ugly. No one likes it. Backbone does the same thing. So if you're familiar with Backbone model, there's .set. Now, the Angular team argues that it doesn't make a difference. No one really notices. I think the talking point is that unless you're Batman, you will not notice these. Basically, I apparently that means Batman has, like, super fast reflexes. I never really understood the analogy. In practice, I don't think that ends up being true. Now, the great irony here, I think, is that if you listen to the Angular team, they basically say, well, this problem completely goes away when browsers get object.observe, which is kind of a new API coming in next version of JavaScript that allows you to observe property changes. So that's great. That actually solves a lot of the performance problems. But I think the irony is that at the same time they'll be getting object.observe, we will be getting object proxies, which is also coming in ES6, which allows us to get rid of get and set. So at the end of the day, it's basically a trade-off that you have to make for yourself. But for both frameworks, these problems are going away.
Mm-hmm. And so something personally I've been a little bit frustrated with Angular sometimes is I would like a way to conventionally wire up some of the finer-grained DOM events. And just looking through as we've been doing this, I've been looking through the Ember to-do application, and I noticed a model with a focus out method. Is that maybe something that's just conventionally...
Yeah, so the Focus Out event is a conventional thing. Is everyone here familiar with the concept of event delegation? It's like a jQuery thing. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening and you're not familiar with this, the idea is that basically instead of setting up an event listener on every single element in the page, which obviously if you have a lot of elements can get quite slow, it basically requires O-N time to run. Instead what we do is we just set up a listener on the document body, and that, which obviously is O-1. And then what we do is if Ember detects an event, that listener basically goes and finds the associated view and it delegates to it. So a lot of people, especially in backbone apps, people will run into this problem because the naive thing when you're doing a view is that you wire up a listener for every view. But if you have a lot of views, it gets quite slow. So we basically do the event delegation for you for free out of the box. And so everything, like event dispatch is just fast for free.
Next topic.
Well, I think the biggest issue with JavaScript apps, like client-side JavaScript apps today, that I think is basically everyone shares the problem is SEO, right? Like Google is not very forthcoming, but everyone's assumption is basically that if you write a JavaScript client-side app, Google's not going to see it. And that's definitely a big problem. So right now the solutions across the board are not good. With Backbone, it's basically figure it out yourself. I know that Angular, one of the things that they'll say is, well, just run your app using Phantom.js, and then you can report that back to the Google service, right? But this is actually quite expensive because Phantom.js requires you to basically boot up for as many requests as you want to handle, you need to have that many copies of WebKit running on your server. And obviously, RAM especially is not cheap. So this is not something that is out yet, but it's something that we've been thinking about architecturally, and our plan to solve this in Ember is actually quite elegant. So I think the first thing to keep in mind is that one of the big differences between Ember and Angular is that Angular relies on the browser's DOM parsing, HTML parsing, right? So the way that you bind attributes in Angular is you basically say like ng bind, whatever. Ember uses handlebars. So one of the downsides of handlebars is you have to wrap everything in a script tag. It's obviously quite annoying. But one of the nice things is that handlebars just generate strings. So what that means is that we can render your templates on the server without requiring a browser context. It's just JavaScript. All it requires is V8 because all you're doing is just concatenating strings. It's quite fast. Now, so that's piece one. Piece two is think about what Ember is doing in the browser. It's listening to changes to the URL bar, the address bar, and when that URL changes, it says, okay, let me figure out what root is associated with that. Let me get the template, let me get the model, let me put them together. Now, you can imagine that instead of the router listening to the URL bar, it's hooked up to an Express app, and it's just listening for GET requests. And you can see, and another thing that we've been doing is because of we use a very similar dependency injection system, getting your application back to state zero, basically the clean state, is extremely cheap. We just say app.reset, and it throws away all of the instances, and you're back to square one. So you can imagine something running on the server, just running a node, no Phantom.js dependency, just listening for requests, rendering a string template, spitting it out, and calling it a day. So again, it doesn't exist yet, but that's basically what we're working on right now, and I think it's going to be a very effective strategy.
So there'll be no penalty for building and losing SEO at that point.
Right. At that point, you basically will have some server that you fire up, you run your Ember app in it, and because Ember apps are so conventional, right, you have these objects that have very well-defined roles in the system. As a framework author, that gives me tremendous insight into what the intent of your application. And because of that declarative nature, I can start doing a lot of stuff for you for free.
So, you know, one dramatic difference, and as you guys are coding stuff up, Rob had to code a lot. You had to write a lot more code, and you were talking about transclusion operators.
So the
takeaway for somebody watching is that they both have a DI under the hood, right? But it's all declarative in Angular. You're wiring everything up. In Ember, it's kind of more convention and just kind of you follow the right path and things work. The thing that I run into with that then sometimes is if you don't know the right path, like you're the language author, obviously, right? So you're going to do well with this. Somebody learning it, you've got to know what to do, right? So how does that, you know, how does that, I don't know.
I agree. I think one of the sources of confusion for a lot of people when they come to the framework is we rely so heavily on naming conventions to get these objects to talk to one another. And if you even just have a small typo, all of a sudden your app's not doing anything, and it's very frustrating. So I think that there's two approaches. So this ends up being a very powerful, like I can write, as I think we saw today in the cage match, I was able to write very concise, expressive code because I knew the naming conventions. I could roll I on it, and I could basically whip something together very, very fast. But if you're still learning and memorizing those things before you feel the power, you're going to feel frustration. So I think two things are important. The first is documentation, obviously, and a lot, especially with naming conventions, having it described isn't very helpful. You really just want to see it in action. So Ryan Florence has been doing a great job with ember101.com, where he has a bunch of basically small, bite-sized videos, screencasts you can watch, very similar to egghead.io for Angular, which has been really, really awesome. And I think it really just helps you cement, okay, what are these objects and how are they stitched together via names? And I think the second most important thing where any kind of declarative system like this, you need good tooling. You need to be able to see, are these objects communicating? How are things being stitched together? We've been working on a Chrome extension that you can run in your browser that's actually really, really neat. It feels like the element inspector, but it actually shows you on the screen the breakdown of controller and model and template. So basically, it's cool. You hover over an area on your screen, in your browser window, and it will tell you what controller and model are backing that. So that kind of thing makes it much easier to debug and say, oh, I see that I don't have a model associated here. Let me try to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I've just been reading through your documentation too. I would say, based on what I've read so far, it's an advantage over Angular.
Thank you. We've worked very hard. You know, a lot of people panned us for a long, long time, and rightfully so. I think documentation is super important. But we were still trying to figure out what are these core concepts, right? We were trying to figure out what the framework actually was. We didn't want to spend a lot of time writing documentation for something that just wasn't ready. But now that we've got the 1.0, we have been pouring a tremendous amount of work into making sure that the documentation, the getting started experience, all this is really good. And I think it's critical. We spend a lot of time thinking about how do we present this information in a way that's not going to overwhelm? How can we use concepts that people already understand? And in particular, Trek Lowaki, who works at Groupon, he basically did the entire Getting Started guide that we have now, and it has been awesome. I think that's really made a huge difference.
That's nice. So you've talked about some things that might be coming on the server, and you've talked about the next version of JavaScript. What else is future for Ember?
So did you guys see Polymer, the new library out from Google? So this is actually really neat. So one of the new specs coming from W3C is something called Web Components. And I know the Angular team has talked a lot about these, and I think they've announced that they're going to be basically building the next version of Angular on top of Polymer. The idea behind a Web Component is simply this. It's a specification that allows you to define your own custom HTML tags, and you can implement their behavior using JavaScript. So one of the things that some of the guys on W3C have been doing, so Yehuda Katz, my co-founder, and Alex Russell at Google, have been spending a lot of time saying, okay, how do we define specifications that explain existing behavior, right? So if there's a feature or behavior in the browser that cannot be explained using JavaScript, then we need a new standard that lets... The point here is to basically let the experimentation on the web platform, the innovation, happen with library authors. Instead of waiting for a new feature to go through the W3C and you go through this really arduous bureaucratic standards process, instead what we want to do is let library authors experiment, and then once kind of there's general consensus about how to solve a problem, then we can start to codify that.
So just to interrupt for a second, but is this part of, I was reading just over the past couple of days, there was a proposal to make that browsers would be more extensible through JavaScript?
Yes. This is a hashtag extend the web forward.
Yeah.
And I'm embarrassed because I forgot the URL. I was going to plug it. Maybe you guys can look it up. I don't have a laptop.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was basically we released, I barely did any work on it, but there was a manifesto released of I'm a signatory on that basically is just a call to action to the standards bodies to say, listen, what happens when you try to have innovation in the standards bodies because it's so slow moving? If you get it wrong, that does a lot of damage because there's no way for implementers to go and fix it. So what we're asking for is to instead say, look, give us the core underlying primitives. Everything in the browser should be explainable via these. Every new spec that you do should be explainable via these primitives. And that's basically a trapdoor, a Turing-complete trapdoor that implementers can fall through if the standards aren't meeting their needs.
Is that kind of like almost like Shadow DOM taken to the next level?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically, that's actually an awesome example. So Shadow DOM is basically the notion that browsers implement a lot of their own features using the DOM. So like pop-ups, there's a lot of DOM going on under the hood, but of course they're able to hide it from you, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at it and it looks like an input tag, but really there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood. So why can't I do that as a developer? Why are browser vendors special? Why do they get to do that? So what the standards bodies are going to do now is basically say, let's try to figure out a spec that explains existing behavior so that other people can go and innovate. And Polymer, so I think there's a term that's come out that I really like a lot. So you guys are familiar with a polyfill. But polyfill is basically like, hey, there's this feature coming in the browser, and here's some JavaScript code that you can run in older browsers to basically emulate that the new feature in older browsers where it doesn't exist. So there's a new term called a prolyfill. And that's basically a polyfill for a standard that may or may not exist in the future. So I think what we're pushing for is to say, okay, look, you're a browser vendor. You want this new feature that makes web development nicer on the web platform. Well, what we'd like you to do is instead of just like slamming it in your browser, instead we want you to write a JavaScript library that lets everyone use it. And this is actually really great because it means that if you start building on top of this feature, you start relying on it, and then that feature gets killed or it changes, it avoids the vendor prefix problem, right? You remember what a problem this was. So imagine if vendor prefixes were just a JavaScript library you included. And that way, if the rest of the world moves on, but you still got your older app and you don't want to change it, you're fine because it's just a JavaScript library.
Wow. Well, I could ask, I mean, it was a cage match. Was there a clear winner, or does it come down to personal preferences?
I'll answer that. I got destroyed. But, you know, this is kind of the thing with the cage matches. I think every year, I'm basically the kicking post.
The fall guy.
Well, yeah. Why do you always take on people who have actually written the other
I know, right? Yeah, last year was Damien Edwards and SignalR. And actually, you know, where it started was we were doing Rails versus ASP.NET.
And didn't you work on ASP.NET?
I did. Well, the what? Team. I worked with the team. I didn't work on the well. Platform. But anyway, so that first year was pretty funny because I remember who's that? Oh, I was dead. I did it with Hadi Harari. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, this is largely Microsoft audience. I don't want to be like dancing around here like Rails. But anyway, Hadi, man, he was rocking ReSharper and just whoom, just whipped up this stuff and he destroyed me, you know? And I was like, oh, that's not fun. So last year, same with Damien. Anyway, this year with Tom, forget it. Just worked me. And then, like, yeah, dropped the surprise on me. And like, hey, can you do this with your loops?
That was a total jerk move. I'm so sorry about that.
So, so you'd been talking earlier to me about, like, hey, I can do anything with directives, right? And
yeah,
that's where you can drop to the low level, right? And so then the curveball you threw at him, Tom, was?
So I asked him to basically have a repeating loop, like an ng repeat, but instead of being a single TR for each item in the array, there would be two TRs in the table.
Yeah.
Which proved to be a challenge.
Yeah, well, he knew it was going to be hard. So the funny thing is like, as I'm standing there on stage, I knew there was a couple of ways you could probably do it, but I'm starting to map the problem in my head. I'm like, oh boy, this is not going to be easy. And then, yeah, you get into the directives, and it's like, oh, jeez, how am I going
to
do this?
Well, I think the really challenging thing is to try to recall directive syntax live without referencing the documentation in front of a studio audience. Like, it's incredibly hard.
I was already on the ropes, and he hit me with that. It's like, okay.
Okay, let's flip this. You know the weaknesses of Ember, right?
Yeah.
Is there something that Rob could have turned and asked you that would have been like, oh, man, I'm screwed?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, he tried the one, which not too long ago actually would have been maybe not a death blow, but it definitely would have been a flesh wound. And that was, so you showed the currency filter.
Yes.
Which was really cool. I don't know how appropriate it is to be in an MVC framework that you have currency formatting, but leaving that to one side, it demos extremely well, and it's very, very useful. But fortunately, we added a new feature in a couple versions back of Ember that makes it really easy to define bound handlebars helpers. So I was like, okay, you have a currency helper. I'm just going to pull in a currency formatting JavaScript library off the internet, drop it into my app, write a small little handlebars. It was literally one line handlebars helper, and just use that. And so that was basically replacement filters. However, if you had list sorting of any kind, basically like sort the list by any kind of property, I would have had to write a lot more code. Because Angular actually has some really nice filters. This is a feature that we're working on because we know it's a deficiency, but in a live demo, it would have destroyed me.
I was thinking about using the filter, but
Yeah, probably would have been a good counter blow, yeah.
There was one other thing then. Somebody asked towards the end a question. They said, well, this is great. You're able to build something quickly, and it demos well, and it's quick to write, but how important is that versus long-term maintainability? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's true. Long-term maintainability is very important, and that's what we focused on at the very beginning, but everyone was like, I can't use Ember, it's too hard to get started with, right? So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. It's like, you can overemphasize the getting started experience, but if the whole story isn't there, if it's not mature enough, then people are going to start to get really, really frustrated. They're going to start running into all these problems of composability, for example. So we focused on the composability problem first, and then we're like, holy crap, no one's using this. Because it's just too hard, right? Like, you don't know. You don't know that you're going to get all these benefits down the road. It takes a kind of a critical mass of people using it to basically vouch and say, yes, I can vouch for the fact that if you use this, it will end up being a nicer experience for maintainability long term. But you need to get people over that hump, right? It needs to be a learning curve, not a learning cliff. So that's why we basically, we went back and where API was rough, we went and basically sanded it over, and we just focused like crazy on documentation the last few months. And so I think now we have the combination, but definitely, I said this, the cage match. We're not like Apple with iOS or Google with Android. I can't force you to use my framework, right? That's a brilliant thing. The kind of Darwinian evolution of JavaScript libraries is such that you have just a few minutes to compete, right? Because programmers are notoriously impatient. So I have 5 to 10 minutes to show you some kind of value. And if you don't see that right away, like maintainability doesn't come into it. You're out. You're gone. It's not like Cocoa where I can make you, I'm Apple, I can say, sit down, read this book, you'll make a boatload of money. I can't say that.
Well, I think we're just about ready to wrap up. And one of the things we do at the end is give everyone a chance to talk about things that might be coming up or things that are exciting or just general words of wisdom to the listener. So you have anything, Rob? Anything?
I have jet lag.
Don't we all? Poor Americans and all.
Yeah, I actually do. I'll throw a little plug for TechPub in. So we just released Scott Hanselman's Get Involved video, and it was one of the most intense projects I've ever done. And it was just a live recording and everything. It was a lot of fun. So following on with that, I have one with Rob Ashton, who basically traveled for a year. And his whole thing was, he'll go wherever people will drive or fly him or whatever and then put him up, but he'll work for free. And so he traveled the world doing that, and I sat down with him for an hour and just recorded a session, like, live. And so we're going to be releasing that on TechPub. And basically, you know, how to travel and work and just basically get out and see the world and break your everyday monotony. So that's what we're doing.
Very cool. Tom?
Sure. I'll give a plug also while Rob's on the plug train. We are doing a couple different trainings in the United States. So Chicago, New York, I think we got San Francisco. So if you are interested in Ember and you basically want to get bootstrapped, it's actually cool because both Yehuda and I are there. I have to tell you, one of the most humbling things as a framework author is to watch someone use your framework for the first time. So if you're interested, our website is tilda.io. You can sign up for training, and I would love to see you in the flesh.
Very good. Well, gentlemen, thank you for being on the show.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening.